Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Many listeners to the Peter B. Collins podcast are aware of ALEC, the murky group called the American Legislative Exchange Council. Now there's an antidote, and it's called Smart ALEC.
Once upon a time, now maybe it was earlier, maybe it was late last week, I suddenly realized what I've always known, that in this whole wide world there's no place like home. I don't know how I know it, or even where I learned it, I might have picked it up on the streets. I only know that if you want to live a happy life, you only got to copy me. Hello, cruel world, would it be alright if I stayed a while?
The activist group Smart ALEC has just launched, and so we open our podcast with Hello, Cruel World. And you won't believe this, but the name of the group, a British pop act, is called Smart ALEC, spelled exactly the same way as Matthew Charles Cardinale spells his brand new organization. Matthew, thanks for joining me on the Peter B. Collins Show today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
And I often, you know, look up theme music before I introduce a guest like you, and I was stunned to find this group called Smart ALEC at Spotify with over 100 songs. All I know is that they're based in Britain. So you should know that there's something going on around the world, and you have tapped into it.
Yeah. You know, the universal Smart ALEC in all of us.
Well, and let me confess, Matthew, that back in fourth grade, that term was applied to me by my speech teacher, Mr. Kane.
So, you some kind of smart aleck, you know? Well, so now I can say, well, in fact, I'm the CEO and founder of Smart ALEC.
Well, and it sounds like you have the right attitude for this kind of work. So let's start with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Committee, or whatever they're called, the C.
Right.
What does the C stand for?
their C stands for Council.
Council, right. And I have looked...
Our C stands for collaboration, but go ahead.
Well, you're also the founder and CEO of Atlanta Progressive News, and I've taken a look at your website. You've done some coverage of ALEC over the years, and
yes.
for my listeners, my introduction to really what ALEC has been up to has come from the website ALEC Exposed, and the
mm-hmm.
fine folks in Madison, Wisconsin, at the Center for Media and Democracy have been...
They're doing some great work there, and they have something called PR Watch, which is what you're referring to.
Right, and they also have a separate site called alecexposed.org. And I'm looking at it right now, and I encourage people, if you're at all fuzzy on what is ALEC and what do they do and why do we care, I'm linking to ALEC Exposed in the show file for this podcast so you can take a look and
Great.
Get caught up. But fundamentally,
Great.
Matthew, ALEC is an organization that fosters the production of legislation on a wide scale that serves political interests who we would describe as corporate, as conservative, as anti-progressive. I think that's
exactly.
Those are all pretty
exactly.
safe terms. And what in particular did ALEC do that got the hair up on your neck that made you decide that you were going to offer us this antidote?
Well, we began to realize that a lot of the legislation that was, you know, and it's Georgia was kind of the testing ground for some of the most regressive legislation, including voter ID. But we started to learn about specific legislation being written by some group called, you know, ALEC, which it wasn't like any kind of secret. It's just that they've been operating for, you know, some 20, 30 years. And what they do is they write this model legislation that is pro-corporate or, you know, right-wing social issues and things that generally benefit Republicans getting elected. So things that make it harder to vote, voter ID things. And so when there was kind of just this seeming spontaneous focus of multiple state legislatures on the same issues at the same time, like, you know, all of a sudden everyone seems to think that the most important thing we need to do is drug test, you know, food stamp recipients.
Right.
And that's, you know, that comes from somewhere. And then it gets replicated. And so there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. It's really the democratic process.
Wait a minute. I think you're being generous,
okay,
Matthew.
Ahead.
Because not only does ALEC offer model legislation, and in a democratic process, anybody is free and welcome to do that. But they have annual conferences where they bring state legislators. They wine and dine them. They promise them campaign contributions. And by the
way, they're close to the public. There are numerous problems with the way that they do it. And you're absolutely right. But fundamentally, those of us who are interested in progressive public policy need to also be taking the best ideas that are coming out of, you know, cities and states across the country and, putting them into a model ordinance form and working to get them replicated. I mean, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that process. And we're trying to, make it about affordable housing, make it about, you know, solving our environmental crises. And these crises are so urgent that what I'm saying is our cities and states are experimenting. They're coming up with solutions. Let's take the best solutions and let's replicate them, because we don't have time to, you know, dilly-dally with, you know, we're talking about global climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, San Francisco is, requiring new buildings to include solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
That's fabulous. We need that in every jurisdiction. So taking the best, you know, the best ideas and putting them into a form for replication. And the reason that I kind of got into that was that I wrote an ordinance called Affordable Housing Impact Statements.
Mm-hmm.
And when I lived in Atlanta, I became very familiar with the affordable housing issues in Atlanta and wrote this ordinance for Atlanta. It actually passed in November of last year. And what it does is it requires an impact statement anytime a city would make a decision, a public policy decision that would have an impact on our affordable housing stock. And since, you know, every unit is so precious to us, as we have homeless people on the street and skyrocketing housing costs, we need to be focused on any additions or subtractions from our affordable housing stock. Well, anyway, that was passed in Atlanta, and within a period of a few months, three cities, Albany, New York, New Orleans, Louisiana, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, had all taken that ordinance and introduced it in a somewhat modified form.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, gosh, you know, I'm basically doing the work of a progressive ALEC. I mean, this is kind of what I've always said we need to be doing. And wouldn't it be funny if I called it Smart ALEC?
And that stands for State and Municipal Action for Results Today / Agenda for Legislative Empowerment and Collaboration. Now, it is a mouthful, and at the same time, it really is a very clever approach to two things. One is you're offering good legislation. So far, you haven't talked about holding conferences where you're going to shower elected officials with cash in order to buy influence. And you're actually trying to return lobbying to an honorable pursuit, because there are many great people who lobby in this country who aren't making big money, who aren't doing it for the moneyed interests, and who are, you know, trying to promote good legislation on very significant issues. And that appears to be what you're up to.
Yes, yes. We want to reclaim lobbying as a positive word. And in fact, I live in Portland, Oregon right now. And I just registered Smart Aleck as a lobbying entity with the city of Portland last week. And so I marched into the city auditor's office and with our form, you know, and on the form we had to put what types of policies we're going to be working on. And so I put affordable housing, the environment, public participation, and transparency. And so I don't know how many forms they get like that. But...
Well, I think this is very interesting. It is clever, it's thoughtful, and it you know, if what you're doing is effective, you're going to help take some of the best progressive legislation on these issues and, you know, pass it around to elected officials across the country for their consideration, and then they can tailor it to the needs of a specific community.
Exactly right. Yes, the needs of that community and kind of the political climates of that community, which are all different as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the affordable housing impact statements, you know, I'll be flying out to New Orleans on June 12th. Their city council has asked their planning department to study affordable housing impact statements, so I'll be working with them. And, of course, after Hurricane Katrina, they've had a huge housing crisis, and... you know, and we've been working with Albany, New York, and they're kind of, you know, they're not the same kind of urban, you know, mega city, and they kind of have some different challenges. So they're going to be, you know, working to educate people on the city council about the need for affordable housing. So, you know, sometimes that's where we have to start, but. Because as we were kind of going along, we're kind of getting used to what the different possible objections could be to affordable housing impact statements. So we know we already have answers, and you know, and so we can help, I guess, you know, get this implemented. And we want to build a national board of directors. We just passed our bylaws. We have a mandate for low income participation. We want, you know, low-income people to be able to participate on our board and come up with actually the solutions. So that's why I don't have a list for you today of what our policies are going to be, because we actually want that to come from a, you know, a national, you know, participatory process that's transparent, and that's just the complete opposite of what, you know, corporate lobbying and the backdoor lobbying is all about. But
well, affordable, I believe that affordable housing is at the crux of many of the social issues that we face. Yeah. Obviously homelessness, but in addition, traffic and commuting issues are impacted. And let me just take a moment to tell you, I live in Marin County, just north of San Francisco, one of the wealthiest counties in the nation. We have very low unemployment, but we do have a significant homeless population, and it's driven by an affordable housing crisis. And the workforce that is employed in Marin County can't afford to live here because home prices are among the highest in the nation. And we have a growing conservative movement in an area that is considered quite progressive of a lot of NIMBY types who say, well, I believe in affordable housing for people in Oakland, you know, or in Richmond across the bay, but not in my backyard, man, because I got here, I made it here, and, you know, I don't want poor people and brown people and other people, you know, living near me. And so there are new forms of discrimination driven by the economic divide, the income and wealth inequality that is really, you know, very front and center these days. And so you're really attacking what I consider to be the core underlying issue that drives, as I said, many of these other problems.
Yeah, and you didn't, you know, and you didn't mention health, the connection between housing and health.
Mm-hmm.
Housing stability and the ability of children to get a good education. you know, I mean, housing is, and if any of your listeners, you know, took psychology 101, they'll remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, mm-hmm. which is that shelter is the most basic need and is the foundation of everything else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so a homeless person will tell you that it's very hard to, you know, do all the things that we demand of people, which is, you know, that they get a job and get, you know, and get stabilized. But once you don't have shelter, how are you going to become stabilized?
Well, and so, Matthew, you speak from experience because you're young for an activist. You're 34 years old, but you have been active for more than 20 years. Which means yes. that at the age of 14, when you found yourself homeless, that's when you began pushing buttons and pulling levers and saying, you know, how do I deal with this and where are the resources and who is going to help me through this?
Yeah. And so that's a story that I've been, you know, been telling for 20 years, which is, you know, my story of being a homeless teenager when I lived in South Florida in the late 1990s, and you know, experiencing the shelter system and experiencing that kind of thing, and going on to, I mean, when I was 16, I was in my own apartment, and of course there are millions of I would say that there are millions of homeless youth and formerly homeless youth who are now adults today, if you really think about it, which means that if you're on a bus or you're in a shopping mall or you're in a restaurant, there's a good chance that one person may have been homeless or a homeless teenager at, you know, at one point in their life. Okay, so I was a homeless teenager and I went on to do, I think, advocacy work really around housing issues. And what I was really pushed to understand was housing as a policy issue. And, you know, the policy issues for homeless youth, I think, are pretty pretty specific because, you know, youth are not legal adults, and, I mean, there's all of that. But when we're talking about homeless adults and homeless families and all of that, frankly, the number one cause is the lack of affordable housing, the cost of housing, the mismatch between incomes and costs of housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fortunate to kind of cross paths with a group called the National Coalition for the Homeless, which helped me to understand the policy causes of homelessness. And, you know, and today, I mean, I live in Portland now, and we have homeless people on our sidewalks. We have an emergency. They declared a state of emergency in the city of Portland, and as a result, they passed an ordinance allowing people to camp on our sidewalks, camp on our riverbank, camp, I mean, public property, whatever. So you could just literally lie down on the sidewalk. That's what we have. And
let me just contrast that with liberal San Francisco, where we have what is called a sit-lie law, which allows police officers to force you to move if they find you resting on a sidewalk or in a public space. And because of the Super Bowl that was held near San Francisco this past year, they tried to sweep the homeless off the streets, and some activists provided tents for people to help them get through what turned out to be a fairly wet winter. And now there's a lot of pushback to remove all the tents and to try to clear the streets without doing much to address why people need to camp out on the streets.
Yeah, and I guess what I want to address is, you know, I'm going from something as substantive as, you know, the experience of a homeless person, you know, than the struggles of homeless people who are sleeping on the streets of Portland, to something as seemingly dry and technical as an affordable housing impact statement. But let me explain why I, you know, after 20 years, I said the solution is we need an impact statement, and it is because there are policy decisions being made by jurisdictions every week, every committee, every agenda cycle. There may be one or more policy decisions. And what I want people to understand is that housing, affordable housing, is a policy issue. So, for example, you may see a sign that goes up that says notice of proposed land use change when they're going to demolish something. And that's something that, you know, a city council has to approve, something that a developer wants. And if they don't approve it, then maybe they don't get to demolish this affordable apartment. That's one thing. Cities also get tons of federal money, and they have to decide how to spend it. That's another thing. Cities, you know, can structure a variety of programs and incentives and requirements and things to create and mandate affordable housing. Those are all types of policy decisions as well. The decision whether or not to have rent control is a policy decision. There are many policy decisions, and I want to focus people on those policy decisions. I want information that has to be produced by the city or the county that will say, if we do this, how many units will be added or subtracted from our housing stock? We need to have this debate. We need to have this information every time. And there's, you know, it will help every decision, you know, in a long-term way. And so that's, you know, that's part of it, but it's also, there's something deep about it, which is, you know, this constant reminder of our unmet housing needs and our unmet goals, really.
And let me,
so
let me,
you
let
know,
me ask,
what are we doing to meet our unmet goals?
And Matthew, let me ask if Airbnb has surfaced in your housing impact analysis, because here in the Bay Area, where the app was developed, we're seeing communities hollowed out, where renters used to be able to live year-round, and now the owners can make more money renting just part-time, or in some cases they turn them into hotel-type rentals where there are new people every night. But the housing stock, both in inner-city San Francisco and in our suburbs, for example, along the coast of Marin County, there are areas where people used to be able to live quite affordably, and you know, yuppie investors have bought the homes, and instead of renting annually to, say, a volunteer firefighter in Point Reyes, they use Airbnb, and they're, you know, making money, and they get to use their house a little more often. And so it's very attractive to them, but there is no replacement housing stock that is being built, and so this inevitably squeezes important members of our community out of the community.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is actually, I saw something on Facebook like today or yesterday about, I believe, Vienna, the city of Vienna.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, this is happening internationally with the Airbnb type thing. So you know, and from what I recall, it was a picture of a flyer that was posted like on a signpost or on a, you know, and it said, you know, this, if it keeps going like this, you know, all the things that people come to visit here in Vienna will be gone. because mm-hmm. we will all be gone. So you'll have this will be the last year to visit something, to have something to visit. So I thought that was interesting. And another problem in Portland is, like you said, moneyed interests, big corporations that are coming in and buying properties, buying multifamily and single family, and you know, and just for the point of making a profit. And so, you know, much of our housing stock is like, you know, no longer under the control of the community, mm-hmm. and into a concentrated, you know, a concentrated control, and it can be very problematic. And I you know, I don't want to scare people, but you know, we may get to a point where we have to take some of that back through eminent domain because we have like a, you know, some kind of emergency mm-hmm. because people are going to be living in like, you know, 10 cities under the highway, and you know, these corporations are going to own all the property, and you know, it's going to sit there empty.
Well,
they would
rather
have it sit there empty than, you know, bring down the price, God forbid.
I think you make a good point, and I just read that in Los Angeles, Mayor Garcetti, who has launched a major initiative and a big budget, too, to address homeless issues, they recently bought a motel that was, you know, abandoned, and for relatively small dollars, they can refurbish that and turn it into a homeless housing center. That
yes.
hopefully could have additional resources to help people who find themselves in that position. And
yeah.
I think
isn't that
makes...
Isn't that funny? It's like the word public housing is coming back. I never heard the word public housing in a positive light than I have over the last few years. You know, Shama Sawant in Seattle is talking about we need an investment in public housing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing about public housing that's intrinsically unsafe or decrepit. I mean, that's just the result of our funding decisions. Yes, public housing to compete with the private market. I don't have a problem if developers want to produce luxury options. I feel like people should have luxury options, but that can't be all there is. So, I mean, we've got to do something. There are many things we can do, and the Affordable Housing Impact Statement is for every jurisdiction to have to navigate this process and say, all right, you know, we're considering this proposal. What is it going to do for us? What is the estimated impact? What are we going to get out of it? Maybe we should modify it in this way. It will create an accountability tool. It will give a means to compare the effectiveness of different things that have been done in jurisdictions. So, you know, each city and county is going to have to come up with its own solutions. And, you know, this is the tool to say, you know, at the bottom line, we have an unmet housing stock need that can be quantified, and let's stay focused on numbers. We don't have to settle the question of whether housing is a human right. I believe it is, you know, mm-hmm. but let's say some jurisdiction isn't quite ready to say housing is a human right. That's okay. We're going to focus on numbers. I think the focus on numbers gets us past all of that quibbling
mm-hmm.
and focused on, you know, the fact that we have, you know, we have almost a demographic, you know, a public planning kind of problem.
Well,
right?
Matthew, I appreciate the value of big data, and it can be used in many positive ways. At the same time, when we reduce these things just to numbers, I think many people feel more comfortable discriminating and making value judgments and saying, well, you know, I don't want any of those people who are in this data line to be living next to me. And because they're not relating to human beings who run the cash register at their favorite coffee shop
mm-hmm.
or work on their automobiles, those kinds of things. I think we need to balance data, which, as I say, can be very helpful in looking at the big picture, with the need to address human issues in a personalized way, not just a one-size-fits-all.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So I'm looking at your website now, and there is a page with affordable housing impact statements, and you link to a report on what you did in Atlanta. Give us a quick thumbnail about the elements of the housing impact analysis that you make.
Well, so basically, each impact statement has two major parts, a quantitative part and a qualitative part. And so the quantitative part is the number-driven part. And that's what makes this this model ordinance unique, because actually Austin, Texas, and San Diego, California, have had a form of affordable housing impact statement for some time. But their questions were more of only the qualitative or open-ended type. So, you know, please describe the impact that this decision would have on housing, you know. What would be the fair housing analysis of this? Or there are different types of open-ended questions. What I was really interested in was the bottom line in terms of the numbers. So basically the scorecard says, for each type of ordinance that's being considered and what its impact would be, it says, this ordinance, if enacted, would have the following estimated impact on the housing stock of, say, the city of Atlanta, mm-hmm. by adding blank or subtracting blank units at 0 to 30% area median income, adding blank or subtracting blank 30 to 50%, 50 to 80, and 80 to 110. And those are common income brackets or income categories. AMI refers to the area median income. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of big cities are finding their area median incomes around $45,000. So there's affordable housing, and then there's like really affordable housing. And I think people know that there's a lot of different ways to define affordable, and sometimes they define it in such a way that it's not really getting to where it's targeting the people who really need the help.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say 80% of the area median income, okay, so maybe that's someone making $35,000 a year. That person may have maybe $900 a month to spend on housing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you know, that person is going to struggle in many cities too. But the people who are really, really, really struggling are the ones making like $15,000 a year or $25,000 a year. And if you're making like a $15 an hour minimum wage,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of where you are. You really should only be spending about $400 a month on housing. And in just about any city, you're going to be struggling with that. And especially to live close to transportation, close to all the amenities that we would want people to live here. So,
mm-hmm.
So this impact statement describes how many units would be added or subtracted at each income bracket. So when a city's getting federal money, we've had that ongoing problem where they're taking community development block grant money, home money, tax credits, other resources that are so scarce with all the cuts that have come from Republicans in Congress and the sequestration and, you know, all of that. So we're saying we want disclosure of who is going to be assisted by this money so that we can have the debate. Stop squandering our scarce resources. And the same thing for land use decisions. You're getting ready to approve a demolition. How many units will be lost? What, and at what price point? So you're going to get something that might say, this land use decision if approved, will result in the reduction of, you know, 96 affordable units, affordable at 0 to 30% AMI, and the addition of, you know, 204 market rate units that will be market rate. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens every day, you know, and in this kind of kind of wonky land use process that a lot of people don't understand.
Right.
But it's the way that they take zoning. They take, you know, things like zoning and push through very insidious changes. And, you know, it's getting to the point where that's one of our, you know, we have to get serious about every single tool we have. And if control over land use and zoning is going to be one of our tools to say, oh, developer, you want this? Well, that's nice, but we're going to require something from you mm-hmm. that's going to help meet our affordable housing needs. We have to do that too. So that's why this process, you know, will say every single time we're getting ready to do something that will have a positive or negative impact on the affordable housing stock, we're going to have that conversation. And then the qualitative section is really to describe how that estimate was reached.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so either, you know, this was a grant application and so that's why we know, or you know, this was a land use change and you know, we did an analysis and this is you know, what the developer is proposing, or this is what the community's vision is, you know, mm-hmm. if it's something more of an open-ended kind of comp plan thing. So, you know, so I think it's just the right information to have a good conversation. And it's really, like environmental impact statements, the value of it will come when there are advocates and stakeholders who are going to come to the table and use it. So if nobody shows up to the environmental impact hearing, then we didn't benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but sometimes people, you know, can stop an entire project because they sue over an environmental impact statement.
Right.
You know, I don't want to scare any jurisdictions that could happen with affordable housing impact statements, but certainly, it's going to open up a conversation. It's going to mm-hmm. open up an opportunity for people to say, well, you know, I don't agree with that analysis. Or maybe, you know, thank you for that analysis. And as a result, I think we need to change the proposal in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew, I really think that you're on to important issues here. Your focus is, you know, very appropriate. I like your attitude. And I want to encourage people to visit your website, smartalec.org, and you're running a fundraiser right now through GoFundMe, trying to raise $100,000 to fund this newly birthed organization, Smart Alec. And I hope that people who are listening who can't afford to make a contribution will consider doing that. And as we wrap up, what is the best way for people in Lexington, Kentucky, Lexington, Massachusetts, or anywhere else across this great country of ours who want to try to collaborate with you and learn from the work that you've already completed?
Absolutely. So people should go to the website, smartalec.org. That's smartalec.org. And Alec is A-L-E-C. So just Smart Alec, all one word.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a Facebook page, which is Smart Alec. And it's actually facebook.com/state.municipal.action. So that's facebook.com/state.municipal.action.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we are looking for people who want to join our board of directors. We're looking for people who want to, you know, help us come up with solutions and you know, elected official partners and the like. The $100,000 fundraiser is to for our 2-year plan, and we want to get affordable housing impact statements adopted in 10 cities and counties by 2018, and Atlanta being the first, we have 9 to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would support things like travel, photocopies, and the like. And And so, yeah, so we, you know, we definitely want people to become part of, like I said, the process of identifying what our, you know, our second model ordinance will be.
Well, we need to take back control of our bathrooms. That appears to be the right wing's biggest agenda item, and
I'm so tired of it.
It sure is crazy making, isn't it? Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. Matthew Charles Cardinale is the CEO and board president, the guy with the great ideas and the smart aleck attitude. I wish you all the best, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Okay, talk to you later.
Hey, you smart alecks. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview. Your comments are appreciated. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until